Whether you operate one forklift or thousands, one location or hundreds, the new My Toyota customer portal can help you optimize your operation and material handling equipment. This one-stop, free-to-use platform is designed to help you take control of your information and make smarter decisions, all at the touch of a button. Register and access your data today at my.toyotaforklift.com. That's my.toyotaforklift.com.
The New Warehouse Podcast, hosted by Kevin Lawton, is your source for insights and ideas from the distribution, transportation, and logistics industry. A new episode every Monday morning brings you the latest from industry experts and thought leaders. And now, here's Kevin.
Hey, it's Kevin Lawton with the New Warehouse Podcast, bringing you a new episode today. And on today's episode, I am going to be joined by Jonathan Briggs. He is the VP of Sales and Solutions at Nimble Robotics. And Nimble has a fully automated 3PL. And we're going to dive into all the details of that. How does that differ from a non-automated manual 3PL? How does that work? What are some of the challenges there? Everything that you can imagine that you might want to know along the lines of a fully automated 3PL, we're going to dig into here with Jonathan today. So, Jonathan, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Definitely happy to have you on, happy to talk about this. I know there's a lot of people are very excited about what Nimble is doing, and I think it's, you know, certainly very futuristic, maybe you would say, in a sense, but you guys are making it happen now. So very interested to dig into this. So why don't you give us a brief overview first from your perspective of what is Nimble? What is it that you guys do?
No, it sounds good. I think very much the future is now. Really seeing this, and it's not just unique to Nimble. I think we're seeing this as you look at all the things that pop up in our LinkedIn feeds, our Google feeds, et cetera. There's a lot of things that, you know, we thought were futuristic and scientific and unrealistic. We're starting to see it, right? You know, our CEO talks often about, you know, making the impossible possible. And, you know, we're seeing that firsthand. So a couple, I guess, key things on Nimble is, one, we at its core are a robotics and AI company, and started in RaaS, so robotics as a service. We took human-like skills of vision and sense of touch and force control and applied those to six-axis robots and then deployed them into other people's warehouses, which really created the baseline and development for our AI platform, right? As we get, you know, you need lots of reps and lots of data for AI to really, really grow and build up. And so, you know, getting into very high SKU, high volume, folks that ran their own warehouses, we were able to do that. So we got, you know, tens of millions of reps that go into this AI platform. And from there, we went into, you know, our second phase, which is we wanted to create a larger scale automation that touched more of the warehouse. So be able to manage the inventory dynamically, slot and have no fixed positions in the warehouse and better utilize a warehouse, right? A lot of the automation today, and, you know, that we see up to today has been focused on throughput or labor reduction or simplifying a task, but not necessarily has it focused on making a building itself more efficient. It's made the process and the people more efficient, but we're also starting to see warehouses double and triple in size because we need more space for robots to go by each other in an aisle, or we need more room for a fork truck to go up and down an aisle and stuff like that. And so we combined both of those things where we redesigned the warehouse, got rid of racks, got rid of aisles, and worked vertically in a building so that we can, you know, ultimately make the building more efficient, not just the process more efficient. And as you can imagine, we still want to sell those types of systems. But when you go from retrofitting a few square feet in a building to asking for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of square feet, people look at you differently and they're not as quick to do it. So finding that first customer to take that plunge is not the easiest thing to do or the fastest thing to do from a go-to-market strategy. So we made ourselves nimble customer number one and developed a fulfillment network around this phase two or a V2 technology that now is redesigning the warehouse. And that's really where the 3PL came from and why we're doing what we're doing in that perspective. So we've deployed three fulfillment centers in our network across San Francisco, Dallas, and Southern New Jersey down in Burlington. And so that's the plan. Now, as we progress, we will continue to build, develop, and utilize that warehouse to meet a middle of the market customer that doesn't have necessarily the means or the volume to justify doing this in their own dedicated warehouse. But at the same time, we will get back to selling systems and deploying those into vertically integrated retailers that that have that critical mass and want to use a technology like ours. And so we see the 3PL network as twofold. One, meeting an unmet need in the middle of the market. And then two, it's an R&D and marketing component to for us to sell systems. So I can bring a customer in and see a scale solution versus coming in to see a center of excellence with four robots and two units of activity that were, you're right. So we can show realistic activity and there's a lot to be said for being a first person operator of your own hardware and systems, because you really truly are walking a mile in your customer's shoes. So anyway, way long-winded. Sorry to get so long-winded and just question number one of the day, but hopefully that gave some understanding of kind of who we are and what we're doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the path and the journey that you kind of describe there on how you're going about building out, you know, not only optimizing just processes within the warehouse operation scope, but also optimizing buildings too, I think makes total sense for how you've put together the 3PL of your own, basically, in these three. And Jonathan, I do have to say, man, Burlington, that's in my backyard. Well, where's my invite?
I thought you said New Jersey. I will get into it later, but yeah, so you're not too far from there?
Yeah, I'm right in Bordentown, so I'm not too far at all. Yeah, I'm probably like 15 minutes away. I didn't even know, so we'll have to figure that out.
I can host you someday and come check it out.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So, I mean, it makes a ton of sense why you're going in that direction. And I think, like you said, you know, our industry, right, is very kind of like hesitant in a sense to go all in on new technologies and things. I mean, disruption, you know, in a warehouse operation is not anybody's friend, right? I mean, we don't want to, like you said, give up, you know, tens of thousands of square feet on, you know, hoping this new technology is going to work or something like that. So, I mean, I love the fact that you guys are kind of, you know, almost putting your money where your mouth is, in a sense, and like, hey, we're going to do it and we'll prove it out and make sure it works. And then we can, you know, pass that on to other people. So I'm curious on the business model sense, though, from the 3PL perspective. I mean, how does it compare to the way that you guys work with, I guess, your clients now in the 3PL side doing fulfillment for them? I mean, how does that work compared to like a traditional non-automated, semi-automated, manual 3PL?
Well, I think in some ways, there's not a whole lot of look and feel difference in terms of, you know, we're integrating into some level of, whether it be a web platform, an order management, an ERP system, inventories placed in our warehouses and orders are sent to us. And then we're pushing information back about what we did with those units and orders and stuff like that. It's more a function of, I think, two things where we differentiate is one is how we do it. And then we charge to do it, I think, are very different. So like, you know, it's not like we're the only 3PL that puts automation in a warehouse, right? We see some folks that do very highly autonomous things. The difference is they're doing it with somebody else's, you know, systems, right? So they're paying a premium with a hefty margin to deploy XYZ robotics automation or sort systems or whatever it is they might deploy. So one, you know, they when that happens, there's a CapEx, right? Because nobody typically wants to use their own money. So there's some form of either front end charge to the end client or some amortized amount over the life of it and probably like a fixed line item on a monthly basis that says, hey, this line is to cover, you know, the system and the capital that we spent on your business. So I think that's one. And then I think it's the level of automation, right? There's very few folks that in a shared use 3PL environment are doing, you know, a dynamic, you know, automated storage and retrieval solution, right? We see a lot of you know, what they refer to as AMRs deployed, or goods to persons, the stuff that's running on the floor without fixed infrastructure, because that's more of a robotics as a service model. And I can, you know, pay per bot per month. And it's, you know, there's not a lot of capital outlay. But we also don't see that that has as huge of an impact in terms of headcount in the building and overall operating costs. So I think that, like, you know, if we sum all that up, the two big differentiators are avoidance of CapEx and then a, you know, really fully autonomous. Like, for example, in my warehouse, I don't have any pickers as a function of our building, right? So we've eliminated the pick side of the business, which is, you know, usually a good third, if not two thirds, of the headcount in the building, especially when you get into high SKU count types of, you know, order profiles of like apparel, footwear, health and beauty, stuff like that, where there's lots of aisles that go up and down. And, you know, we see a lot of headcount. So we've eliminated that component. So we see a lot smaller personnel and, you know, headcount in the building. And we see it all overall, a much smaller building because I got rid of the racks. I got rid of the aisles. I shrunk it down. I work vertically 30 feet high in all of my buildings. Mm. You know, I need probably, you know, 20 to 25% of the square foot that a lot of my peers need to get the same type of throughput. So those are the big difference. But ultimately, there's a transactional component to everything I do, right? I'm going to charge for receiving. I'm going to charge for picking. I'm going to charge for packing, storing, returns, et cetera. So in that regard, it's not much different, but hopefully our price point's a little bit more competitive. And, you know, there's some, I think, inherent capabilities that come from it, or some, you know, improvements in terms of like inventory accuracy, as an example. You know, we have a closed access grid that nobody can get into once we put that product away without leaving, you know, digital footprints and tracking to say that, you know, Jonathan Briggs requested, you know, these five units to come out. So if they're missing, Jonathan Briggs is on the hook, right? Like, so yeah, right. So there's, you know, it's not like we can walk up and down the aisles and do a little Christmas shopping as we go down there. And, you know, so we impact things like shrink, we impact inventory accuracy, order accuracy as a result of the systems and the controls that are in place. Mm.
Very interesting. And very interesting that you have no picking labor. I mean, I think that's a huge thing, right? So it kind of leads into the next question here. I mean, when you look at, you know, in our industry now, I mean, obviously there's, and part of the reason for such a push and spike in automation solutions and all these different technologies coming out is due to labor challenges, right? Trying to get people in the door that, you know, want to come in the door, number one, and then want to stay in the door too. I think number two, right, is the challenge, right? And people are just, you know, not necessarily interested in that type of work, especially for the long term. So, I mean, when you look at your solution and how you've set this building up or these buildings up, I mean, how does the solution kind of address some of those labor challenges? I mean, you said there's no pickers, but I mean, if you look at your setup in one of the buildings, for example, compared to a typical building, which would do the same kind of throughput or have the same square footage, footprint. I mean, how much less labor are you looking at?
Oh, drastically. You know, probably, I don't know, I'm probably trying to think of a scaled building here. Like on any given shift, you know, we run about 10 to 15 individuals non-peak. At peak, we might double that to like 30 to 40 people. In my past, you know, that would be, for that type of volume, would have been more like 100 to 200 employees on a shift, right? So it's pretty drastic. And one of the things that's interesting, like we have a full task robot. And what I mean by that is our robot can do end-to-end the entire task that a person would be hired to do. That's the one of the biggest differentiators, right? Like when we look at, you know, all the different bots that you see in our LinkedIn screens and they're moving something from point A to point B, they are a material handling equipment. They still need somebody to take something off of it or put something on it at the beginning or end of that motion. Mm. We are able to do the picking, do the packing, do, you know, where we historically needed people, we've created that into the AI platform and the hardware that we've created to be able to do that end-to-end task. So that's one of the biggest areas that we can impact the labor is, at least through that pick through pack motion, we can do that with a full task robot. And so that's some of the the biggest differentiator. And as you can imagine, how do you scale that, right? Because I've built systems around unit level activity. I play heavy in direct to consumer and omni-channel. Those come with huge surges. They're not very predictable. You know, I shouldn't say it. There are some brands that do continuity and subscriptions that are, you know, very predictable, but most of the brands are not, right? They interact with a customer 1 to 2 times a year. They chase demand and run promotions, or things go viral. Somebody gets caught wearing an item, and all of a sudden there's 10,000 unforecasted orders, right? Like you know this as well as I do. And so we have a fleet of, you know, robots that we can expand it, and we can, you know, shrink it back down again as needed. So, and historically we would do that with people in a traditional environment that's very manual. You would throw more people at. The problem is you can't just turn people on, you know, in a minute's notice. And you typically, if they're going to come work for you, they want to work more than half a day or half a week. And so there's a lead time to staff it. And then you've got to commit to a period of time versus we can look at the forecast that, you know, coming through in the middle of the night and be like, hey, we need to run, you know, 10 more bots today. Mm. And you know, we might need one more person, right? Like it's not that big of a deal, or we can just extend the shift and we might not have to add any people. We just run a, you know, 2 hours longer on the shift as an example. So we have good ways, I think, to flex it and scale it up as well as shrink it back down for when it's not needed, I think, a lot faster. So it's very responsive and adaptable than if I have to go to a temp agency, put in 40 requisitions for a job and hope half of them show up. Right. And then, do they keep working? How long does it take me to train them? All those types of things that are very problematic with a very spiky business that is e-commerce fulfillment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's such a great point about, you know, it's such a challenge to, I guess, get the people, like you said, you know, you put 40 requisitions out there, maybe half show up. Right. And then maybe, you know, 80% of them stay for the whole day or something like that. I mean, it's
maybe one actually is a worthwhile employee, right? Like there's a lot of turn and churn in that process.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's definitely like certainly a delay there. And, you know, even, you know, you look at, you know, when it comes to peak season or something, you're hiring people ahead of time and just, you know, keeping them on basically just so you make sure you have the headcount you need when the time comes. But I think being able to, like you said, easily kind of dial up those bots and instead who, you know, already know what they're supposed to do, I guess, right? Already trained in a sense, you know, it certainly makes it a lot easier to deal with some of those labor challenges. So I'm curious, like you said maybe 10 to 15 people in the operation. I mean, so what are they, if the robots are doing kind of end-to-end processes, I mean, what are they doing? What are the employees on site doing?
Yeah, I'm still manual on a dock, right? So I've got to unload trailers. I've got to break out cartons. We forward deploy everything. So in our dock to stock process, I'm going to go from, you know, a pallet or a carton to a unit within, you know, 1 to 2 days, and I'm going to forward deploy everything. And then I treat the bottom of my storage system as back stock and my upper half as forward stock. So very different than, you know, somebody that might put pallets on a rack and then do an internal transition and stuff. So lots of people there, right? So I got to look at, touch, count, inspect, you know, do that twice to get it into the grid. Depending on the pack outs, I still need a lot of people at pack out, right? So if I have any type of, you know, value added service work, or I'm, you know, still haven't automated my box process. I've automated where I've got poly bags, but I still, you know, so there's still a lot of manual pack out in our business. And then I have manual sortation for my parcel. And then I've got to load trailers at the end of the day. Right. So we're still in that, you know, majority of my headcount sits on a dock in a current environment. We've got a lot of R&D stuff in the roadmap where we've been deploying, you know, robotic pack out into auto bagging. We want to do the same into Corrugate and bring in some third party solutions that do box on demand so that we can, you know, have less packaging types and do, you know, scan the products and then, you know, 5 feet down the conveyor line, we're wrapping it in a conveyor, you know, wrapping it in a case and labeling it. So that will be third party when we go to that level. We don't need to recreate the packaging wheel that people have done so nicely. So we're vetting that out heavily. So that will impact a lot of our product today. And then I've got things in development right now in terms of robotic sortation, to where we can do strategic sorts for our carriers, and, you know, not just like break it out by, you know, FedEx, UPS, DHL or whatever. We want to start to get granular, build routes, build hub and duct loads. If I need to get granular at a zip code level for some of our city-based carriers. So all of that, like, for example, in our first level, I asked the team to give us up to 200-way sortation capabilities within that. So like we can get like super granular.
Yeah.
So that's been in motion. We're working on that. We've got some really interesting concepts that we're working on around the unload and load of a trailer, whether it be, especially if it's a loose load, which most of our stuff in both directions. Okay. Inbound is typically, you know, floor loaded containers, and outbound is, you know, loose loaded parcels going into a parcel network. So we have a nice roadmap. We have to obviously do that in iterations, right? Because R&D is expense, you know, so I have to balance, you know, the tasks and the projects based on, you know, revenues and growth of the business, and little by little, we'll go down that pathway. So we still, you know, there's still some very manual parts in our process, and candidly right now they're very critical parts, right? Like I think receiving at its core is where success and failure, in my opinion, happens in this industry.
Absolutely.
Because POs aren't always right. Mm-hmm. Manufacturers aren't always right. Like, so there's still a lot of value in having that to be manual for us, so that we can get it right, get it, you know, make sure that, you know, if there's, you know, shortages or damages or overages that are happening at the PO level or something that's happening in transit, we're catching that right away so that we can push that upstream, and our brand partners can go back to their manufacturing and sourcing partners and say, hey, you shorted us 10 cartons. And, you know, that's not a shrink thing. That's a PO thing. And then that way we put in that closed access grid we were talking about. Now we've got a control. Like, we know we're really comfortable with what's in there. And so as we do our cycle counts and stuff like that, we feel good about if there's anything that's out of scope, we know who to blame, and it's ourselves. And so there's not a finger pointing contest down the road because we took a pallet, put it on a shelf for 2 months, and then realized it was short eight cartons or whatever they could be, right? So we hear all those horror stories. So that is an important area. And obviously there's, you know, when we talk about fragile items and we talk about any specialization or personalization of a pack out, we still need people to get involved there. So I think we've got, you know, very critical people in very critical positions to make sure things are, you know, successful, doing QA, doing QC, appropriate dunnage, appropriate packouts, those types of stuff. But over time, we feel confident we can automate those with high success. It's just a, you know, it's a development roadmap and a bandwidth issue that we've got to do those in stops and starts.
Yeah, interesting. And I think that makes total sense. And, you know, I mean, there is a lot of kind of unique touches in a sense where especially when you're involving e-commerce type of pack out and that type of fulfillment, whether it's, you know, custom packaging a certain way, something needs to be wrapped or something like that. And I love that you're taking into consideration the quality side on the inbound as well. I mean, I think, you know, it's kind of garbage in, garbage out, basically. That's kind of where the whole process starts, right, in the warehouse. So it's great that you're focusing on that QC as it's going into your system, and definitely interested to see kind of as you guys develop and do R&D on that, what your solution might be for automating that in the future. I think that's a very interesting thing, but there is certainly a lot of complexity, ton of variability on those inbounds there can be in terms of, like you said, whether it's correct PO, not correct PO, or even just variability in size of packaging within a container, things like that. So very interesting to hear kind of on that labor side where that falls into play and how the automation kind of helps to reduce that pretty substantially on headcount and where manual labor is still needed. So I'm curious on the, since it's fully automated, right, and you guys are using, if my understanding is like sort of a ASRS type of system as well in there for storage. I mean, do you have limitations on kind of the types of products you can put into the system? I mean, what's really like your, if you look at it from a 3PL perspective, I mean, like what's your ideal customer profile or product profile?
We'll be back after a quick break. You hear a lot about supply chains these days, because if the past couple years have taught us anything, it's that an efficient, well-managed supply chain is absolutely critical to keeping businesses successful and consumers happy. I'm Will Haywood, and I host a podcast called All Business, No Boundaries, where we talk about supply chains, how they work, what happens when they don't, and the innovations that are redefining what's possible in the world of logistics. Join me for insightful interviews with thought leaders and industry experts. We discuss how optimizing supply chains can break down the barriers that are holding businesses back. That's All Business, No Boundaries by DHL Supply Chain. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, no, great call, right? There is definitely a lane that we need to stay in. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head. We've got our own automated storage and retrieval system. You know, one of my first limitations is I use a tote that lives at about 4 cubic feet. So okay. I've got to be able to fit an item in there if I'm going to be able to use automation. Now, I've got customers that maybe that's an outlier SKU. Like, we can operate outside of the grid, but ideally, the value of what we're doing is operating within the automation, have it be automated picked and all those things. So first is can I get it in the tote? And ideally, can I get lots of it in the tote, right? The more I can put in the tote, the more dense I am, and you know, more things make more sense for our warehouse. So one is that. Two is the weight of it. I have a picking weight limitation. I have a stack weight limitation. So, you know, we want to, you know, units that are under 20 pounds an item, and then storage totes that are under 50 pounds collectively stored. So we have to do some kind of, like the airlines do, some load balancing and some, you know, we may have to split, you know, a SKU into multiple locations as an example, or we may need to, you know, split a tote and put some lights and some heavies in there just to make sure that we don't have too much. For the most part, we don't have that problem. But there are a few SKU profiles that I see in the business that we need to do that load leveling and weight and balance shift. And so then the other one for us is ideally a more sustainable or minimalistic pack out process, because I want to automate as much as I can. Yeah. And so if I need to, you know, tie ribbons and bows and handwritten notes and put kissy faces on a note, like that robots aren't intended for that. And so, you know, ideally, you know, for us, it's things that I can put in a, you know, some type of a, you know, mailer or poly bag, or I can do in the future some type of automated case erection for it and get people out of that process. So, you know, we typically refer to that as VAS, light or value added services. You know, we don't want to get into all those extra touches there if we can. So I think those are probably the three biggest things. When you boil that down for like simplicity's sake of verticals, and not to say it's exhaustive, but it simplifies a little bit. Like for us, that's primarily apparel, footwear, health and beauty, nutraceuticals, CPG, and small electronics. It seems to kind of check all of those different boxes that I was referring to. But I'm sure if you went in the warehouse and watched orders drop, I'm sure I have other verticals than that in there. But for the most part, those tend to align, right, where it's, you know, small, lightweight, complex SKUs, complex orders. You know, I think the more SKUs we see in a profile of, you know, what's on hand from an item master, coupled with higher units and SKUs per order, the more value we create. Because if you boil that back to I'm pushing a cart up and down an aisle, or I'm meeting a mobile robot to put something on or take something off, it lends itself to more walking, more touching and stuff like that. And so our system that, you know, has eliminated that picker in that warehouse gets more and more valuable the more complex things are. But not to say I don't have simplistic profiles and stuff like that, but, you know, in general, if you think about it from an engineering standpoint, there's some order profiles that are actually make more sense to not automate than they do to automate, because you're just adding in a layer of complexity and a layer of cost that aren't needed, right? Like if I had a two hero SKU order profile, and, you know, 95% of my orders are either one or two or both of these SKUs, you're probably going to do some type of pallet pick and label stick operation, and any other automation you bring in is just slowing it down and adding cost to it, right? So we have to be mindful of that to not be like a Rube Goldberg and like over-engineer something that doesn't need to be engineered. And so that's where we tend to see things kind of settle out when we go through, you know, discussions with customers and RFP processes where we win, et cetera.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting too, the kind of the, some of the complexities there. I'm curious, like when you mentioned the, like the load balancing of the tote, or, you know, like certain items could be in the tote and certain other ones couldn't. I think I saw on the website, some of the videos, like you guys have dividers in some of the totes where you can put multiple SKUs in there. I mean, does the AI and the system that you guys have developed, I mean, does it over time understand that, like, hey, this SKU can't go in this tote with this SKU because the weight is going to be off? Is it kind of dictating that placement? How does that work?
Yeah, great calls in there. And I'm going to answer a couple additional things in there on that topic. Sure. But first, I'll answer your question. And yes, there's two ways to it. In the front end, we can hard code it to an item master, right? And so some examples of that is like hazardous material. Like we want those in certain parts of the grid. So, you know, for safety reasons, fire suppression, all those types of things. So, and also that has a requirement when we go to pack out. So we will item master some of those things, but absolutely we know the weight and the dimension of every product in the warehouse. And we do that on a first SKU receipt every time we're going to capture a weight and dim. And so, it will know those things. The other thing is we look at the order profiles. And AI is also part of that, where we're looking at SKU commonalities. And so we refer to this as peanut butter and jelly SKUs, where typically if I buy peanut butter, I buy jelly at the same time. Okay. And so we're going to look at those like products. And if they can fit in the same tote, we actually want to deploy those divided. So they're still living at a single SKU location. Mm-hmm. But when I go to a bin, either a person or a robot can satisfy a much higher chance to satisfy that order with one bin presentation than having to get a second or a third or however many gotcha. In there. And so the whole system is dynamically slotted. And so we can, and the system is doing this naturally by itself. So this is where I think there's a huge value where, you know, a lot of my life, I walked up and down aisles with corrugate totes that were fixed position and inventory, as you know, like, it might be an A mover for a while, and then it's not, right? Like there's seasonality, there's life cycles. But what happens in a fixed position, you tend to just start putting the wrong material in the wrong locations because you have fixed bins. If you're doing that, where now my A's or my C's and my A's are in my C locations, I'm now inefficient. I might be longer walking. I might be higher picking on a on a rack or a cart. I might be having to go ladders to do high picks. And so now my productivity and throughput goes down, which ultimately translates into my cost goes up because I negatively impact what one of the key measurements in a warehouse called units per hour, or UPH. And so then the alternative is for people to do that and say, hey, I've got a WMS that does dynamic slotting. Now I got to pay somebody to go out there and repurpose the warehouse and move bins or move product. And so nobody likes to go through that exercise because they're paying in all those examples. You're either paying somebody to optimize the warehouse or you're paying for not optimizing the warehouse. And neither is a good thing. So our all of our locations are positionless. And so by order activity in the AI, it naturally reslots itself. And then one of the things we added last year is what we call dynamic slotting and system coupled with system directed put away, where I now, as I'm receiving, let's say I've depleted inventory of this SKU commonality but I don't order them all at the same time because I've got more units of the other. When I inbound it again, I can now scan it and the system will say, oh, you know what? We want to call tote 5002 over, and you're going to put this in the corner of tote 5002. So now we're keeping that SKU commonality alive because, and without any traffic and without anything, we just hit a button, out comes that tote, and we put it away, and then it goes back into the grid wherever it wants to go to. And so that'll change. Like I may not change the peanut butter and jelly SKUs, you know, day to day, but I would change them every time we replan. That commonality may change. And so as I've exhausted that location and I bring in new units, the system will say, you know what, it's best that A and B go together, and A's already living there. So we'll call it out and put B in with A as an example. So, but then the actual physical location of that is changing hourly, daily, whatever the case may be. So it is optimized from that perspective.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's so smart because, you know, like you said, in a you know, the typical, I guess in this point, we're talking the future here with what you guys are doing. So say the old school way of doing things, right? Like you mentioned, you know, you walk through and, you know, you have all these bins and there's, you know, this item is a hot mover for this month. And then all of a sudden it dies down for whatever reason. And then, you know, you take time to rearrange. If you do take time to rearrange, and sometimes by the time you reslot and do all that stuff, you need to do it again in some cases, right? So it's great that the AI and kind of the system is able to look at those things very smartly and intuitively to be able to bring those things to the forefront and allow those types of moves to happen over time. So very interesting. I'm curious, you know, from a customer perspective, since you guys are, I mean, I guess you have customers that are using your technology from a solution perspective, but now you have these 3PLs, so you also have customers that are using you as a fulfillment service, right? So when you look at the customers from a fulfillment perspective, are the customers coming to you because they're looking for an automated solution partner to be able to do their fulfillment, or they're just looking for different options and you guys come out across the table? I mean, how does that work, and where kind of, I guess, is the customer client mindset at right now? Are they looking for 3PLs that have automation?
Well, first of all, I appreciate using an audience submitted question on that. I believe that came out of our LinkedIn catalog. So
yeah, well, shout kudos out to Rachel from Resonant Link. She's the one that submitted that one. That was a good question. So
yeah, so thank you for participating. But no, I've been thinking on it ever since I saw her post that. And I think the short answer is no. People, well, one, don't know we exist, right? Like, we are, I think, one of the best kept secrets in supply chain right now, right? Up until middle part of last year, we were completely in stealth mode about fulfillment, even though we've been running it for, you know, a couple of years at that time. We wanted to make sure we got it right before we started banging the drum, right? So, you know, up until Q2 of last year, our website didn't even mention anything about a 3PL, right? And so, so I think one is, and we're not on we don't do SEO optimization. And I don't know if that's a thing anymore, right? I think the internet has changed so much in the last 18 months. I don't know what's what anymore, but you don't find us on page one, let's put it that way, when you look at Google or whatever. And then like ChatGPT lives in legacy data. So if you ask Chat about us, we probably don't show up in there. And, you know, so we do, you know, I think we're surprising and delighting most of our customers. I think one, they don't know we exist. And there's not a lot of, if any, other models. Well, for sure, from a vertically integrated perspective, there's not. There's maybe some other autonomous providers that we talked about that are using third party. So I think, you know, a lot of, there's mixed schools. Like, some people like don't even care what's in your warehouse. They care that, can you handle it? Can you execute it? Can you do it high quality at a price point that makes sense for my unit economics, right? And how you do that, I don't care what your secret sauce is. Like, they think of it as like a black box warehouse. And so there's a school of buyers and consumers of 3PL that think that way, that like, I don't know, no, I'm not an operator. That's why I'm coming to you. So that's one group. I think the other group is they're just dissatisfied with what they currently have. Right. And so they're looking for something. We think of the 3PL journey as kind of similar how we, at least historically, I speak as an old guy here. I don't know what it's like today, but my journey of home ownership started with renting a small apartment shared with a bunch of buddies, to less buddies renting apartments, to I bought a house and then leased out rooms to other buddies. And then it was a small house to a medium house to, like, now we would call it our forever home. Right. And I think that happens. There's kind of three stops in the journey. There's the startups. Like, I don't even know what I don't know. I've never placed an order yet. I need to get started. So there's that starter group 3PL. There's kind of a middle of the road 3PL. And then there's that, like, I know I can, whatever I do from here on out group, that I can solve all of that, right? So we see people at different stages of that journey where I've outgrown my 3PL. I like my 3PL. They just can't keep up my growth because they only have X amount of square feet and they don't want to build a new building for me. Or they just do not know what they're doing and they don't have any systems and they can't get people to come in and I'm too surgy and I, you know, whatever. And I don't, so there's this, like, so more often than not, people are looking because some dissatisfaction or some something has gotten thrown at them that they need. And sometimes also the 3PL breaks up with them and says, hey, we don't want you as a customer anymore. And so they're just not looking, and they might stumble on us because they hear a podcast like this. Mm-hmm. Obviously I have a sales team, they're outbounding, and they just catch people at that right time that says, hey, actually your timing was good, I would like to chat. And then we get we get into those conversations like, oh my goodness, I didn't even know this existed. And like, so it's kind of, it's a surprise and delight more that there might be, I can think of one customer in the last 2 years that I've been here that actually reached out to us because they knew about what we were doing with automation. And they actually, they reached out for the wrong reason. They wanted to see if we could put our robotics in their 3PL. And then it was like, well, hey, by the way, let me tell you about our 3PL journey. And then they're like, oh, well then yes, we were excited. So like even that one person that was looking for what we were doing was looking at us for the wrong reasons in that example. So, but I think this will change. I think ultimately people should be thinking, there's big problems out here, right? Like, and I think we solve a lot of them, like, labor's a problem, in terms of availability, cost, et cetera, quality, you name all the things. Buildings have gone up. Even now that we're seeing demand of buildings go fall, we're still seeing rates, have a 5+ percent GRI. So buildings are expensive, and obviously transportation is a huge problem, right? And so if you think of your day to day, like all the things, a lot of our discussion, right? Like I've got huge surges, my 3PL gets into backlog often, and then I've got to upgrade, or I've got a discount, or I've got to appease a bunch of angry customers because things didn't show up on time, or I've got inventory problems, or I've got order quality issues. And so like you're saying, all right, well, if that's a labor intensive environment, why would going to somebody else that's a labor intensive environment be much different than that? And so I think at some point in time, you really have to like ask yourself, what are the problems that we're facing? Why are we seeing the issues we're seeing? And then how do I avoid those in the future? And I think you have to ask yourself, I think I need some level of automation, and, it may not be our automation, but you need something, right? You need to do something differently than what you're doing today. And when I see the common trap is, oh, well, so-and-so is cheaper than what I'm paying today, so somehow that's going to make it better. And I don't know how that's going to make it better, right? Your unit economics might get better, but in general, if I'm rinse and repeating and I just go from 3PL to 3PL to 3PL with the same problems and I haven't solved it when I go to the next home and the next home, I'm going to be forever looking for my forever home and never find it unless I just accidentally get the right person and stuff like that. So to answer that really succinctly after I spent a long time talking about it is no, I don't think people are asking that and it's just an accident, but I think they should be, is probably the better way to summarize that. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think all really, really great points in there around that kind of 3PL relationship and search, like you said. I mean, it's not always about the cheapest price, right? And, sometimes the cheapest price is going to get you, what the cheapest price will get you, right? So, it's really important to understand that. And I think, I think even if I was, a brand and I'm looking for a 3PL, I think the appeal of you guys, addressing those labor challenges would be appealing to me, because I would know that, say my product has a peak season and, do I need to be concerned that the 3PL can cover that, right? Or am I going to see orders that are delayed because of that, right? Which is not a customer experience that I really want to have for my customer. So I think it's really interesting the way you guys are going about that and able to present that to the brands. So thanks for answering that audience question there. So I guess before we wrap up here, I'm curious, obviously you guys are still developing some things. You mentioned some R&D kind of projects there around certain automation, but I'm curious, what does the future of Nimble look like? I mean, are you guys, is the goal to become full lights out dark warehouse, or is there a different kind of future in mind?
Great question. So the shortest answer is the future is going to be autonomous, right? And so we have a long-term vision to be an end-to-end or fully autonomous supply chain company, and that actually expands outside of the warehouse, right? So so we obviously we talked through some of the journey, right? Like I've got to do everything from receiving dock to shipping dock and everything in between there. I want to automate that. So we want to get as close to lights out as you possibly can get. I think the short answer is I don't think lights ever get turned off is my thought there. But that's what we want to chase, is that theory and concept that we don't need lights in the building. Mm-hmm. But we also have concepts that will go into delivery trucks and inbound containers and inbound trailers, and we'll put robotics in the equipment coming to and from us. Mm-hmm. Our longest, pole in the tent, if you will, and where we see the longest horizon is on the transportation side. Our ultimate theory is the box or the poly bag and the shipping label, that all that is useless for all of us as an end consumer.
Yeah.
It's a means to an end, meaning it's you've got to be able to get from point A to point B in a carrier network. It's hub and spoke, that's high touch, high damage rate, all these different things. But if I can localize inventory close by and I can actually do fulfillment in the delivery truck, I can deliver the package in the same item that it sits in my shelf in today, because I don't have to go through, 10 miles of conveyance and be able to survive an 18-foot drop height if it fell out of, a carrier's top level of their sort system. And so what we think is coupling our robotics with autonomous delivery and, just like a look behind the curtain, one of our, first board members is the founder of Waymo. Mm-hmm. And so, we've got connections and areas that gets us, to use that. And so I don't think we're going to create autonomous trucks. I want to make sure I clear that up. But I think we'll complement it with a solution that we've created. Whether or not I get rid of the driver or not, I can, push the envelope on picking, right? Because I don't now I have to have cutoff times, because I got to get an item picked. I got to get an item boxed. I've got to get it labeled. I've got to get it in a carrier's cutoff time. If I just know I need these 10,000 units on this truck, then I just got to take bins and get them on a truck. Mm. And then we can, drop the orders in real time as they're and say, all right, we're going to Jonathan's house. Let's get his two units queued up and do some. And so whether that is still a driver behind the vehicle, I began my career at UPS a million years ago, designing routes manually back then, loop detail and routes. And almost 20% of a driver's time is spent behind the bulkhead door getting packages and sorting packages. So if I can, every time the driver pulls up to a stop and that order is sitting there ready to go, and all I do is turn and grab and go, I've made that truck 20% more efficient in terms of its time. So now I can get more stops and more throughput on every given truck that I've got on the road. So even if I haven't automated the delivery side, I can use that concept and save all that up and down the aisle time in the back of the truck, touching the same boxes over and over again. And just, I go to stop, I grab a package, I'm up the door and I'm back. So we see this playing into delivery in the long term. And, we got a long way to go to get there, right? I got to solve a whole bunch of different things. But yeah, so to answer your question, fully autonomous, chasing that lights out dream. Like we want to be end to end autonomous when it's all said and done.
All right. Very interesting. And very interesting there, kind of the fulfillment center on wheels almost, it sounds like maybe. And I think it'd be really interesting to see how you guys continue to develop this. And I'm sure you already have some things in the works as well. So we'd be very excited to see those as they get unveiled and brought out here into the world, even though it'll be lights out, brought out into the spotlight, I guess we'll say, right?
Exactly.
So Jonathan, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today and learn more about Nimble and what you guys are doing. Really interesting, exciting stuff for the industry and from a technology perspective as well. If people are interested in learning more about Nimble, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, nimble.ai is our website. Go check it out. We got a contact form. I also live heavily, as you've seen, on LinkedIn. Yeah. So, look me up on LinkedIn. I'm an active participant in the community. I like to network. I like to talk shop. Please reach out. If something we talked about was interesting to you.
All right, great. And we'll definitely put all that information at thenewwarehouse.com as well, so people can easily find it. So Jonathan, thank you once again for your time on the show today.
You've been listening to the New Warehouse Podcast with Kevin Lawton. Subscribe and check us out online at thenewwarehouse.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you want more content from the new warehouse, check out our new video series called All Hands on LinkedIn. Just search for the new warehouse on LinkedIn and follow along.